Hey, I'm Johnny. I'm an alcoholic.
Amen.
I'm also a drug addict and a thief and a liar. Maybe a prostitute. I don't know. I did some strange... That's for another meeting, though. Look, I'm really glad to be here. And, you know, I've been in treatment a few times. And I was pretty sure that when I left, everything was going to be different. And I was okay. And then I'd leave treatment and I'd get drunk. And I couldn't understand how that happened. And I don't mean to say that to scare you. That's not my intention at all. It's because we really suffer from a disease that is cunning, baffling, and powerful. So I like to think I'm a reasonably smart guy. And I like to think that... you know, when I apply self-will to things, I get things done, because I have. You know, there's this part in the book where it talks about self-will, and it says, what happens? It doesn't usually come off very well, right? Has anybody read that? It came off fine. I didn't have the experience of things never working out. A lot of the times I was able to manage and squeeze whatever I wanted. The thing was, I wasn't happy. You know, I was miserable. So I guess what I'm going to talk about is being happy. I don't know. It seems it's weird to me. You know, Chris and I were talking. Before I got sober, I didn't have friends for 15 years. You know, like people talk about this guy they went to high school with and stuff. I don't even know any of those people. And but I guess we can't start there. I'm going to really try not to drag you through my life story, because quite frankly, I don't think you want to hear it. But I'll give you the highlights. Most of them are screw-ups. I didn't think I was raised into a bad family or anything like that, you know. I had a single mom and an uncle that I think he thought he was a biker. He didn't have a bike. But... He liked to kind of have that persona, you know, and he thought he was a tough guy. And they were musicians, and I wanted to be a musician. And then my mother got married to a guy, and he became dad. You know, he's my stepdad. He was all right. There was no alcohol in the house. My family was Mormon, so, you know, there's not a lot of that going around. But that was kind of what was so mysterious about the shit to me. You know, I wonder, well, why is it such a big deal? Why does everybody want me to stay away from this stuff so much? I was interested in drinking before I even knew what it was. And this uncle, you know, there was a time in my life history where he did some inappropriate stuff with me, and I share that because he didn't have any hold on me, But I found that when I do share it, there are oftentimes guys I'll meet later who had that experience too, and they never told anybody. But I didn't know, you know, really what was usual, unusual, you know, to grow up with. My life was okay, you know, but there's this thing, you know, I didn't, and by the way, forgive me. We'll get to the part where life is incredible and all this. It's also exhausting. There's a wife and kids and stuff now, and let me tell you, I was sitting there thinking, it's like, wow, I really had planned on getting ready for bed at this time. Man, I didn't ever go to bed at 8 o'clock. Who is this guy? All right, anyway. So, I didn't really think I was different than other kids. I was absolutely different than other kids. I grew up in Louisiana, and though I lived in New Orleans a long time, that's not where I grew up. I wish I did, but I grew up in a very, very, very redneck part of Louisiana, and I discovered punk. Now this is going to matter, because it was like there was this world somewhere outside of Louisiana where everybody's completely fine being different, and they seem to be okay with themselves. All this is created in my mind. And so if I could just get there, I'd be all right. I remember thinking that when I was a kid. You know, so music was a big deal to me. It was a way for me to be somewhere else, you know. And I always wanted to be somewhere else. I always wanted to be somebody else. I didn't ever want to be here. I didn't want to be me. And I probably didn't want you to be you either. And I didn't want to be here. I just wanted to be somewhere else. Something wasn't right, you know. Something was out of place, and my life didn't make sense. I played football because cheerleaders are cute, and I somehow thought it didn't work, by the way. But I kind of thought that if I played football, that I'd fit in. I don't particularly like football. Love baseball. But there were no cheerleaders for baseball teams, so that didn't make any sense. And you know, I did it, and it gave me, you know, I was always a misfit. I never fit in with anybody. But all the popular kind of preppy kids had all the good positions, you know, quarterbacks and stuff. I was bigger than the other kids. So I got to just tackle the crap out of them all the time, and it made me feel good. And then there was this football game unrelated to ours that people were going to, and I wanted to go. And I've been watching a lot of – is anybody like Clint Eastwood? Are any of you old enough to – okay, good. We're on the same. All right. And I talk about this all the time. I can't help it, but it's the only thing I knew about drinking, right, was that Clint Eastwood would walk into a bar probably after killing 15 people on his way to get there. But he was calm and collected, and he'd walk up to the bar, and he'd order whiskey. And he'd do it like that. And if you know Clint Eastwood, you know what I'm talking about. Everything was through the teeth. And then he'd drink it, and he'd make a little, I don't know, maybe curve his lips, something that looked really tough to me. I was like, oh, I got to get a bottle of that shit. And so there's this football game going on, and I'm with the tough guy liquid. And so I asked the uncle, the biker guy, I said, who didn't have a bike, I said, can you get me some whiskey? It's the only name I knew. I didn't know there was like multiple types of whiskey. And he said, well, what do you want? I said, you know, whiskey, you know, regular old, good old whiskey, whatever that means. He said, you want bourbon? I was like, Bourbon Street. Yes, bourbon, I'll have it. And he says, well, how much do you want? You want a fifth or a pint? And again, I was in school, right? So a pint of milk is this big. So I figured a fifth, who can that hurt? I'll do a little fifth, you know, that'll be fine. I didn't know a fifth was a fifth. I still don't know what it's a fifth of. But it's a big-ass bottle. And I was like, whoa, this is a big jug of manhood right here. And I didn't know that, like, other people would mix it with stuff and, you know, put ice in it and Coke and other ungodly things. And so I wanted to drink it like Clint did. Clint just, you know, he used a little glass, and I didn't have a little glass, so I just did it out of the bottle. Wow. So the Mormon kid takes his first slug of whiskey, and like, my eyes were swollen. I couldn't breathe. It was burning all the way down to my stomach. I thought I was going to throw up. I thought it might burn a hole right through and I would die in this car. And I wanted more. Oh, man, that stuff worked so fast for me. And I was a little taller when I drank it. I was a little bit tougher. And I was much more relaxed. I was pretty happy. And I drank a little more, and I was a real celebratory fool. And next thing you know, I'm throwing up all over the most popular guy in school, and I woke up at home. And that's it. That was my great drink. And I thought there was supposed to be a little more fun than that. But, man, I remembered how I felt when I drank it. You know, if I could just kind of manage, you know, the amount, and I developed skills really young. I somehow remembered or hoped that I brought home what was left with me. There was only about this much left in a fifth. That's a lot for your first drink, to drink that much. I probably spilled a whole lot of it and probably gave some to other people. But I had my first hangover that day, and it was Sunday. My parents were good Mormons, so by God, we were going to church. It was like, Jesus. And like my head is just pounding, and somehow I thought, if I took a drink of that stuff, it might make me throw up, but it might make church better. And so I took another drink. I didn't drink every day or anything like that. Jeez, I was 12. But I might have been, yeah, I was 12. Might have been 13. And it provided this way out. I felt different, man. I felt completely different. And as often as I could drink, I would drink. And then, hey, I didn't see you. And as often as I could drink, I could feel better more often. So that's just math. And so cutting ahead a few years, I was the only kid in my high school with a mohawk. And nobody understood it. And I guess I wanted attention. I certainly got it. The principal called me in and said that either I was to shave it or I had to leave the school. That was an easy answer. I gave him the finger, I left the school, and I went straight to my buddy's house because I knew he had pot and I knew he had access to liquor. I didn't even like pot, but it changed the way I felt, so I'd smoke it if I had to. And there's a lot of blank spots going on in my life, so that's good news for you. The life story can't be that long. Most of it was in blackouts. There was a girl, and she didn't get pregnant. I kind of made her that way, but we were together, and, you know, I guess that's dating. And I didn't really know anything about, you know, pregnancies, and I didn't know anything about women either, but seemed like a good time to get married. That's a grown-up thing to do. So we got married. That was not the best idea. I went in the Army, and I started to exhibit some other things outside of alcoholism, maybe. Maybe it's alcoholism. I was none too right in the head, I'll just say that. And I, when I went to the Army, I guess I was detoxing on some level. I didn't have the ability to be a heavy drinker yet, but I wasn't in too long. They sent me to a shrink, and they suggested that this is not the guy we want to handle explosives. And so they suggested that I find employment elsewhere, and which was fine with me. I mean, these guys get up at 4 o'clock. You guys ever remember TV ads of the Army and stuff like that, and they're playing basketball? There was no basketball. There was nobody was sitting around having a good time slugging each other. These guys are getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning. They're wearing, now, I love combat boots, but not at 4 in the morning. And they're getting dressed, and all your shit's got to be pressed. And then they're going to run, and all this. And this is way too early. So they would run, and I would go back up and sleep under the bed until they got back. Nobody noticed. It just didn't make any sense to me. It didn't sound like anything I wanted to do. And everybody's yelling all the time, and they're telling you to get up, get down, stand this way, that way. And I didn't fit in. There was this little issue I had with authority, and that would play out the rest of my life. And I got back, you know, and the new wife wasn't particularly happy. I kind of worked at it. I think the longest we ever spent together at one time was like 2 months. And then we'd split up, you know, all this kind of stuff. And all the while, I'm drinking more and more, and I'm loving it. And I'm playing in a band, and I'm a rock star in Louisiana. Nobody played where I lived. So that made me pretty much the rock star of the town, right? Because there were no other bands. And she left. We split. I think she was, the baby was 4 at that time. I'd see her off and on here and there, but eventually I didn't see her at all. And And, you know, everything else just picked up speed. You know, I discovered that I could drink, and then I could incorporate a lot of other chemicals. And with this chemistry set, I can drink for days. I can stay awake with all the outside other stuff. By the way, anybody never had any outside other stuff? Yeah, I didn't think so either. So I get a lot of cleaning done sometimes when I do the other stuff. And I started going to jail. And, you know, I discovered guns. And not only are they not fireworks appropriate for the 4th of July, they're terribly dangerous. And man, I like that. Mix that with some blow and some music and a lot of drinking. And I'm just having a party all by myself in the house, you know, guns and drinking and blow. And, you know, I moved here to Austin. It was a decision I made in a drunk, actually. Somebody sitting somewhere in the vicinity said they were moving to Austin, Texas. And being the Louisiana rock star I was, I felt I could really bless you if I moved here and really turned you on to the Louisiana punk scene. real big there. Anyway, my life all along the way just started to fall apart. You know, my parents, I didn't think I was hurting them. I just stopped talking to them. And so they didn't know where I was. And I didn't see that baby girl anymore. And I didn't see much of anybody anymore. And it wasn't until I got sober, like I said, that I had friends for 15 years. I didn't have friends longer than maybe a year. It depended on what your worth was. You know, you had to have a net value measured in what you could do for me for us to really be friends. Somehow, I went to an AA meeting once, and sober, dry, whatever it was for a few months, and that was just god awful. I was miserable, and it was one of these little stints I had in a treatment center. I had a choice of prison or treatment, so treatment center good, and I think if you don't work the steps, you just get to be sober and miserable, because there's this other half. There's all this drinking and drugging I'm doing, but all this stuff I told you about earlier, where I felt empty and apart from, and all this other stuff. That's today. Even I still feel apart from a lot of times, and so I drank and I just stayed that way. And I didn't want to get sober. And I moved to Austin because somebody said they were moving to Austin. I wanted to go. And so I got real, real drunk, and I woke up on a bus, and I was already on my way here. boy, was she surprised. And I met this other girl, lots of girls, but there's some that are pivotal. This one, it was inconvenient that she was married, but it seemed that she was really into me, and I was really into her being into me. And so we were, you know, dating, which, you know what that means for us. It means we drank and did drugs together, and I woke up in her house, and her husband complained. And he complained a little much, you know. And at one point... I was a little violent. Not that I'm a tough guy. There's not a tough bone in my body. It was I did a lot of things out of fear. I would beat the snot out of people because I was afraid of them. And I don't know if you can identify with that, but it seemed like to me that if somebody stood up to me or you know, anything other than how you're doing, they're probably wanting to get something over on me. And so I'm just going to get it over on them. And we're going to get that out of the way. And so this guy walked up to me and he says, you trying to make time with Amy? That was her name. And I said, yeah. And he just kind of looked at me. He says, well, you know, she's married. I said, yeah, and I'm drinking. What? I said, let me tell you something, buddy. If I ever see you again, I'm going to break your legs. Don't you ever come up to me and talk to me again. And he knew I would. And I hate that. I hate that today that he knew I would. And, you know, he ended up moving out of her house. It was probably a good idea because I was moving in. And I'm a crappy roommate. And it was awkward anyway. We would get drunk and do tons of drugs, and it was wonderful. I was unemployed most of the time. But I was a musician, you know, so I was starving for my art. By the way, I'm a horrible musician. I just, you know, I played at it, and then I've got friends that actually did it. Like, oh, yeah, toured around the world. You ever do Louisiana? I did the Louisiana tour. We also did San Antonio. So, yeah, I liked living that way, but I didn't have, like, the fans part or the ability. But anyway, it was, you know, what do you have to have to do punk in the first place? If you're not familiar with punk, there's some trash cans we can go beat on outside. Yeah, you don't have to have a whole lot, just a little bit of anger. And if you can rhyme or not, you can probably put together something. So we did some psychobilly bands. It's like a mix of rock and punk rock and rockabilly. And it was fun. It was a lot of anger, and the girls were cuter. And then they couldn't even tolerate me either. My own dipshit bandmates started to have a problem with my drinking and my drugs. My roommate, who was a heroin addict, kept ODing, and he came and talked to me about my drinking. He's like, you know, you really drink too much. I'm like, you were dead yesterday. You don't care. Anyway, it was another night, and there were police involved or whatever, and so the girl in question decided she was going to go to Houston for a week. Awesome. I can do all the blowing up I want. She'll be gone. She came back with a desire chip. And I've been to the AA, like I told you before, and I knew exactly what that meant. I knew the changing people, places, and the things, and to get rid of your playpen or whatever, however the hell it goes. I knew that I was going to be out. And so with a bag of Coke, I decided to go to a meeting with her. I wasn't going to drink. I'm supportive. And we went to a meeting, and I was like, yeah, this, you want this. That's, I don't want this. And to be supportive, we went to another meeting. And I can't tell you what they said because I just don't remember. But somebody said something in there that sounded an awful lot like me. And it was peculiar enough that I thought I'd go back by myself just to check and see if I really heard what I heard. And I didn't want her to go with me because I didn't want her clapping and all that kind of crap. I didn't want any part of that. So I wasn't going to hop onto a stupid bandwagon in the first place. And I had a drink now in a couple of days, and I was not feeling very well. And this guy that was talking, I could tell that he drank and used like me. And I could tell that a lot of you guys drank and used like me. But I wasn't sure if you had like the really crazy stuff going on in your head like me. And that's where I thought maybe this wasn't going to work out. Because there was always like this hum going on in my head that it was just minutes away from complete disaster. It's always felt that way. Later I would find out it's called fear. I thought it was cautiousness. And I talked to this guy outside, and I didn't really have any social graces, and I didn't realize I had the guy by the shirt, but somewhere there was this cord of desperation. And I told the guy, you gotta work the steps with me then. And he kindly kind of pulled me away and he said he would. I didn't know what that meant. I knew there was some God mentioned in there, and I'd grown up with some weird stuff. And so I sort of thought this is probably a big brainwashing operation. I needed it. If it was brainwashing, I needed it. And I knew I did. And I was finished. It wasn't any of the trips to jail that did it. It wasn't any of the car accidents, the people I robbed, anybody I hurt. It was none of that. It was just something broke. All right, mainly it was the girl. Other than the girl, something broke. And I just can't do this anymore. You know, I'd wanted to die, and I'd sat there with a gun in my mouth before, loaded. And I didn't have the guts to pull the trigger. Because the flip side is, what if I lived? And I was like that guy that can't walk or talk, and now I got a hole in my head, and I'm sober, and I can't get my drink, and I can't tell you to get my drink. And, I mean, there are worse things than death, right? And so I started this journey, and what this looked like for me was very difficult. Step one was relatively easy. I was in the room, right? Step two was a little tricky because it meant that I had to consider this definition I had of God. And they said, you can come up with your own conception of God, but that's not how I was raised. You don't get to have your own conception. There's two volumes and a whole bunch of extra books that tells you exactly what your conception is to be. And the guy suggested, in some form or another, to try to forget everything I think I know about everything. I said, okay. And we moved on to step three. And I really wanted it to work. Are there any kids in here that can... Okay, not old enough. Because what my prayer life looked like wasn't very pretty either. I'm fortunate that God is tough enough to handle some of my language. But I looked at these steps, and I really couldn't do much anymore, right? I mean, I tried even going back to church. And if you're Mormon, I don't mean any offense. It just wasn't my bag. And I don't think they didn't really like me either. And so when I would try to pray, and somewhere in the back of my mind, I was like, man, this is just going to be one more screwed up thing somewhere along the line. There's some catch. It's all positive thinking. Look at all these people hugging and holding hands and shit, please. And I would pray, and I would do a step, and I'd pray. I'd say, okay, God, if this doesn't work, it's your fucking fault. I'm going to work the steps. I'm going to do the little things. You get your sponsor. I'm going to do the little things. And if it doesn't work, it's your fault. And I'm not going to do anything again. Because there was this, you know, somewhere in all of us, there's a fundamental belief in a power greater than ourselves. It says that in the book. I know that there are people that claim to be atheists. But upon about a 15-minute conversation with me, I find that they're not really atheists. They're more like me, which was a little more agnostic, that maybe there's a something, but that something isn't really concerned with me because look at my life. When we got to the fourth step, he tried to explain to me, you know, there's pages, if you've ever looked at the book, about the fourth step. I felt that was way too complicated. And I said, well, look, man, the fourth column is kind of extra detail. There's who it is, what they did, and what they got coming. And we'll just do that, and I'll write a list of that. And then we'll sit down, we'll pray about it, and hold hands and hug. And he says, man, do you really want to be sober? I said, well, yeah, I'm doing this. He says, then shut up and do the steps the way I'm telling you. Well, nobody talked to me like that before. I said, okay. All right, well, how are you supposed to do it then? He says, well, let's go back to the part where I told you to read the book. And so we sat down, we went through it. I mean, it looks like a foreign language. I didn't use words like resentment, fear. These weren't part of my everyday language. And so we're going through all of this, and he's showing me the shape of what it's supposed to look like in a set of columns. And he said to go straight down, not across. This guy's a little anal. Okay. And I went straight down, not across. And me and this guy developed a friendship, right? And I knew that the fifth step was coming. There's some really bad stuff in there. There's stuff I haven't told anybody else since, because I don't know what happens when you tell a whole room full of this. I don't know how, you know, if there's any agents in the room or what. And so I said, I'm not going to do this with you. I really like you. You're a good guy, and you're a good guitar player. You got to work on your singing, but I can't. And so I got this other guy, this poor guy, man. He's been sober like, I don't know, 30-something years. This big older dude. And he was kind of like, I don't know, he looked like the Buddha of AA or something with glasses. And he thought he was coming over to help me with a fourth step. He didn't know he was coming over to hear one. And so, you know, I did the customary tough guy Johnny thing, and I told him that I'd find out where he lives and all this kind of stuff. He says anything. Anyway, I got into this great, amazing, horrible American novel type story. Dude falls asleep in the middle of my fifth step. I didn't know what to think of that. You know, I thought he was looking down or praying or something, but he hadn't moved in a while. And his, I said, are you listening to me, John? And he was like, oh, yeah, go ahead. You know, he'd listen some more. And you know what I found out? I found out my story's not particularly interesting. I found out it's not unusual. I found out that I have as much in common with most of the people in AA than I have ever had in common with anybody in my life. I finally found my people. And guess what? They're all drunks and drug addicts. What a good fit. I then went through the rest of the steps and got another sponsor, and things started to look up, and I was about a year and a half sober. I'd managed to hold down a job for a while, and I got in touch with that little girl, you know, and if I moved to Memphis, I could make amends to her, and then I could be this, I don't know, dad type guy. I always wanted to be that guy, but I didn't know what it meant, really. I didn't have the garage with the tools in it and the treehouse. I didn't know exactly what it meant. So I told her that. And I moved to Memphis, and I lived there for 3 years. And I'm, by the way, my parents had moved there too. And I was able to straighten out the wreckage of my past with my parents. You know, and my mother, which I'm a total mama's boy, by the way. There's nobody means more to me than mama. She said, you know, there were times we just didn't know if you were alive or dead because we hadn't heard from you. We knew what you were doing. And my mother must have run into an Al-Anon somewhere along the road, because I remember a phone call I made where I was asking her for money again. But I was doing it in such a way that I was suffering, you know, so she'd really see my pain. I said, you know, Mom, I've only eaten rice for the past 2 weeks. She's about to write the check. I just know it. She says, well, you know, rice is the only food that's good for your spleen. This, enable me. I'm trying to get you to enable me. Write the damn check. You know, and I think that was the last time I talked to her, probably. And so now I'm in Memphis, and I've got a job, she's about to graduate high school, and she's off doing, you know, 18-year-old things. I don't know what that is, really. And I really wanted to get back here because there's this one guy I met, Chris, and he's the only guy I've talked to straight through all the way since I've been sober. He eventually became my sponsor, but not at first. He was just that good, solid friend I could call that'll tell me the truth. about myself. I didn't like that. It really made me angry at times, and at times I thought, stay over there. I thought I might shank him. Because I didn't like it, man. Some of this stuff hurts, you know? And I'm glad today that I have people that love me enough to hurt my feelings. He doesn't care anything about my feelings. He cares more about my life. And so I asked permission for my daughter to move back here so I could live where I wanted to. I hated Memphis. And I did. And we stopped talking again. It's like I blew it. I had a spinal injury, and I had to have a surgery, and I couldn't do the type of work I was doing anymore, and things were not looking real hot. And I had this idea, because I'd heard enough people get up and speak and talk about their life, I had this idea of going to school. I wasn't sure. I was pretty sure I couldn't do it. But I knew that you get a little bit of financial aid, maybe that'll dig me out of a hole for, you know, a semester, and then I'll figure it out. And I got in, and I'd been a high school dropout, so I don't even know how many years that was. So I went back to school at the tender age of 38, and I'm, 6 years sober, and I got an A in something. And then I got another one. And then I ended up with A's. Said, oh, they feel sorry for the old guy in the room. That's what this is about. You know, we climb to the top of the heap or we hide beneath it. You know, there's no middle ground. It's possible that I had enough intelligence to get through algebra. I don't know. I found out I could do this thing. Now, the reason I bring it up, why do you bring up college in an AA meeting? Because it's something I never thought I could do, you know, besides hold a job, besides stay sober. You know, eventually, you know, I had this list of things that I would dream up, what my dreams would look like, and then they all start coming true, and then they're all true. Then they've all come. Now I'm going to come up with new dreams. I called Chris once, and I said, what do you do when all your dreams come true? This is just, you got to start coming up with new dreams. And I stayed in college, and it was scary, man. I was going to Texas State. I was doing a ton of inventory. I don't bore you with that story. But I graduated. Graduated magna cum laude. Then I stayed in to get a master's. And then I taught political science at Texas State. And now I work for an education technology company as a partnerships manager. I still get to work in education because, man, that was like... it was like going to another planet. And then I ran into my drug dealer's ex-girlfriend. Turns out she's sober. Oh, man, she's always been so gorgeous. I just couldn't stand it. And I was, she calls it stalking. I was looking around a lot intensively on Facebook. And I noticed that she knew Chris's wife. And I thought, now, that's weird, because they would never run into each other in any other circumstance unless that girl's sober. And I saw some other people on there. Anyway, long story short, we got married. She had a set of twins that were 5 at the time. They're mine now. Then we had a baby. We had a baby that just turned 2 in February, the light of my life. How big can your life get? I don't know. I'm the happiest I've ever been, and I'm as stretched as thin as I've ever been too. And it's all had to take a bunch of inventory and work the steps along the way, because if I'm going through the rest, I stopped with you guys at 9. There's also 10, 11, and 12, and it's not one damn step. We always talk about it, 10, 11, 12, 10, 11, 12. You know, 10 is something I've got to be doing constantly, all the time. 11 is the other thing I've got to be doing all the time. And then 12 is where I have to go and do something like this, or I work with other people. I work with a lot of guys. Most of them get drunk. I don't think I'm particularly a good sponsor. But I just do what my friend does, which is he just tells me what he did. And then if I go do that, the chances are I'm going to stay sober. But it's not just about being sober. When I left treatment that time, I thought that it was about not drinking. Here's the news flash. You're not supposed to drink. You're an alcoholic. So there's no award for that, really. You know, I get to be a big shot because I've got 15 years sober now. No. I'm not supposed to drink. That is the point. What have I done with that 15 years? What am I doing with that 6 months? What's happening in that 30 days? Because the majority of my life is spent now trying to shorten the distance between the problem and the solution. We've got a method for it if you've looked through the steps. This is supposed to become reflexive. It's supposed to become part of my daily habits. The book says that it's a way of living that really works. And it does. And it has solved all of my problems. The way I tried to figure out what I wanted to do for a living, I used the same thing as I used for a sex inventory. I came up with an ideal. And then I asked God to help me live up to it. My wife is a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And she works the steps like nobody's business. And she is totally comfortable in taking my inventory and sharing it with me. I'll just tell you right now. Marriage, they tell you marriage is about that love, that deep love, and that life partner. No, that's true. It's about compromise. It's about forgiveness. It's about compromise, and then just giving up entirely and let somebody else have their way. And I found that when I do that, I'm happy. Chris has always, he told me the other day, he said, you want to be right or you want to be happy? I thought they were the same thing. They're not the same thing. They can be the same thing, I guess. You know, today I have a life that I could not have imagined when I walked into these rooms. I came up with some great stuff. That, you know, somebody said, write down what you want your life to look like and blah, blah, blah. And all of that is so far gone. It's unreal. But it's not unique, guys. Like, stuff like that, if you're encouraged at all by what I've told you, I'm telling you now, it's not unique to me because I'm speaking. This is repeated anywhere and everywhere with anybody who does these things. And we really do this stuff. And when we do it, it's uncomfortable. I still don't enjoy inventory. I'm so sick of calling Chris with the same damn thing. The same fear, I'm afraid I'm going to lose my job. Really, again? We did this yesterday. I know, but today's different because there's I hate it, but it's the only way I get to have this life. It's the only way I get to grow. When I got here, my life was about the size of a quarter. Now my life is the size of 10 football fields. But if my spiritual life stays the size of the quarter, there's no way I'm going to meet the demands that this life has. There's absolutely no possible way because there's too many moving parts now, right? I'm a family of five. I'm not just a guy. I'm not a very good, this is all new to me, by the way. The daughter that didn't talk to me, in November, she reached out finally to make amends. She's now a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, serves on committees for the conferences and all this kind of stuff. We have a great relationship. I talked to her tonight. We were talking about AA, and then it hit me. I'm supposed to speak tonight. And so I had to get off the phone. I called Chris. I'm like, I remembered it. Yep, ready to go. You know, I just can't remember where it is or what time it is or what I'm supposed to do. So if you're new here, and you don't understand some of the language that's being passed around in these rooms, that's fine. If you're new here and you don't know what you think about God, that's fine too. Don't worry. God meets you where you are. You don't have to go looking real hard. God shows up. But you'll understand that in the book, it talks about a God consciousness. I want you to just think about that for just a minute. A God consciousness. I used to think that it was if I prayed hard enough, God would come and intervene, that God would finally show up. God consciousness is realizing he's been here the entire time.
Thanks.